From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama plays the carbon card in an historic move to reduce US greenhouse gases by 30%.
Since power plants are responsible for about 40% of America's carbon pollution, these new standards are going to help us leave our children a safer, more stable world.
Also today, Qatar's 2022 World Cup hopes could be shown a red card. And the Sergeant Bergdahl backlash. The White House defends the release of the US soldier from Afghanistan in exchange for Taliban commanders held in Guantanamo Bay.
This was the right thing to do because we in the United States do not leave our men and women in uniform behind during an armed conflict.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Spain's King Juan Carlos has abdicated after 39 years of rule. In a public address, he said it's time to hand things over to a new generation that's better equipped to handle Spain's new challenges, as legislators prepare to hand the throne to Crown Prince Felipe. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman has more.
In a surprise announcement, 76-year-old Rey Juan Carlos abdicated the Spanish throne, leaving Prince Felipe of Asturias to take his place. Spain's king said he made the decision with great emotion, but that a new generation of younger people with new energy are needed to carry out reforms. Spain's monarch has been accredited with helping the country transition into democracy after the fall of General Franco's fascist dictatorship in the 1970s. The Spanish royal family has been the subject of controversy involving tax scandals in recent years, and King Juan Carlos was personally criticized for attending an elephant hunt in Botswana during Spain's financial crisis.
America's Environmental Protection Agency is proposing a new rule to cut carbon emissions from power plants. It is designed to target high emissions from existing coal-burning power plants. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The proposed new rule would force existing power plants for the first time to cut carbon dioxide emissions. The goal is to cut the national average by 30% of 2005 levels by 2030, but targets and methods will be crafted for each individual state. A key opponent of such reforms, the Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell from the coal-producing state of Kentucky, calls the proposals a dagger in the heart of the American middle class.
The Obama administration has come under fresh fire over its decision to free five Taliban commanders being held at Guantanamo Bay in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who was handed over to U.S. Special Forces on Saturday after 5 years in captivity. Critics of the U.S. administration say they've negotiated with terrorists. The White House, though, is sticking to its script. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's condition is said to be stable, but he's receiving treatment for conditions, say officials, that require him to be hospitalized still. He's also said to be having trouble speaking English. Critics accuse the White House of negotiating with terrorists and putting U.S. national security at risk, but White House spokesperson Jay Carney is holding the line.
The assurances were sufficient to allow the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, in coordination with the national security team, to determine that the threat posed by the detainees to the United States would be sufficiently mitigated and that the transfer was in the U.S. national security interest.
After treatment in Germany, Bo Bergdahl will likely go to a medical center in San Antonio in Texas, where the process of reintegration begins.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden has asked Brazil for asylum. The fugitive, who has been living in Russia since receiving refugee status there in June last year, said he strongly disagrees with Moscow's policies on the internet and censorship. However, Mr. Snowden said being in Russia was still a better option than prison time back home in the United States. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
In an interview with the Brazilian television channel Globo, the leaker said if Brazil offered him asylum, he'd gladly accept it. Brazil's foreign ministry, however, so far has not confirmed whether it had received a formal asylum request from Mr. Snowden. The fugitive leaker said he strongly disapproved of many things in Russia, especially the way it monitors the internet and censors the press. But day by day, he added, it is better than prison. Mr. Snowden's asylum deal with Russia expires in August.
The U.S. Justice Department has announced it's taken down a global computer network used by cyber thieves. The server group was known as Game Over Zeus Botnet and was used by criminals to steal millions of dollars and spread malicious computer viruses around the world. 30-year-old Russian national Evgeny Mikhailovich Bogachev has been charged with directing the group. He's been indicted on 14 counts, including hacking, wire and bank fraud, and money laundering. FBI Executive Assistant Director Robert Anderson called Bogachev one of the most prolific cyber actors in the world. The Game Over Zeus group first began online attacks in 2011 and have infected millions of computers around the world ever since. Law enforcement agents also announced they've seized a group of computers that was the center for a virus called CryptoLocker, which blackmailed users into paying a ransom to regain control over their computer. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Obama administration is going to war on carbon emissions. A draft Environmental Protection Agency plan unveiled on Monday will force US coal power energy plants to reduce emissions by 30%. That's by year 2030. Opponents to Mr. Obama's historic climate change policy argue the new regulation will cost jobs and damage the economy. Following the EPA announcement, FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddick spoke to Vicky Arroyo, executive director of the Georgetown Climate Center.
Really, for the first time, the power plants, existing power plants, will have their carbon emissions regulated. And so it's really a new day for power plant emissions here in the U.S. And what EPA announced was, across the country, a 30% cut in emissions from 2005 levels. So quite significant.
And how effective do you think these regulations are going to be? As you say, they do deal with one sector, albeit a very powerful sector. And it is also, I think I'm right in saying, up to different states to choose how they implement these rules. So could we see potentially a patchwork of states, some implementing them more effectively than others, even though pollution obviously doesn't know about state boundaries?
Sure, but that's the case as it is right now, right? I mean, we've already had, you know, years of state inaction and companies not really being to understand how to invest their money because they think a carbon constraint might be coming, but they don't know what it looks like. We didn't succeed with the climate bill. There's sometimes talk about a carbon tax. There's sometimes talk about this EPA regulation, but now they'll have regulatory certainty to make these investment decisions. And so I do think that people will pretty much fall in line over time. There will be some challenges, we expect, but I do think that EPA is on solid legal footing.
In terms of the criticism of this, many on the right and in the Republican Party in particular have raised concerns about job losses and harm to the economy. How credible are those and how should the administration be dealing with them?
Well, you hear those, of course, before every regulation. I've been working on environmental issues for more decades than I want to admit. And it's always the case before a regulation, whether it be a flexible regulation like the one announced today or a more traditional regulation. You know, they roll out the horror stories and they just generally don't come true because the group of people that need to really meet that standard innovate and they find ways to do it. There are people who make money because of the new standard, like people who will be investing in weatherization programs, efficiency programs, building new, more efficient appliances, moving to renewable energy sources that are manufactured here or at least installed here. So I don't think that that's going to pan out. It hasn't panned out in the past. And in this particular area, we actually have seen states with a track record, like the states in the Northeast that already have a cap and trade program called REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. They've been able to cap their emissions and reinvest some of those proceeds to where they've actually created 16,000 or more jobs in the region and a net economic benefit of $1.6 billion.
The Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, has said, you know, $51 billion a year could be potentially lost through higher electricity prices. Is that not a legitimate concern?
I think that's not a legitimate number. I think that there might be some transitional higher individual rates, electricity rates. But again, depending on how the state structures their policies, if they choose to take some of that investment and plow it back into weatherization programs and efficiency that manages the demand for these resources, we'll be building fewer coal plants, which have, you know, multiple other environmental concerns associated with them. Of course, you know, asthma and respiratory diseases that come from the other traditional air pollution as well as carbon pollution. And so you have to really take all of that into account, and I do not believe those numbers.
And just finally, what would you say to, you know, say I'm a miner in Kentucky, I'm worried about my job, in coal, the Republicans are saying to me, you're right to be worried, the Obama administration is out to get people like you. It perhaps doesn't mean a whole lot to me that maybe overall climate change is a problem, or that children with asthma, you know, in a state far away are suffering. What do you say to me to try and convince me this is a good idea?
Sure. I mean, and I'm from Louisiana, which is an energy state, and I can certainly get the concern about a transition to different sources of fuel when states really have their economies often almost exclusively invested in some of these fossil fuels. But I do think that most people, certainly the younger generation, understands that diversification of that economy over time is a good thing, investment in alternative energy sources in those states, so that those states can hopefully continue to be energy states. But yes, they might have some different sources of energy. You know, the coal jobs have decreased over time anyway, both with the shift to Western coal, which actually just is less human intensive, less labor intensive, but also because of environmental regulations and because now the prices of wind and solar are very cost competitive. So I think that people have to see this as a transition. I think the way that EPA is allowing states to build on their own programs that make sense for them. Gina McCarthy made it clear today that she's not looking to completely shut down coal or natural gas, that they have to be part of the solution. There are efficiencies to be gained from how those facilities operate right now.
Vicky Arroyo, Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center, talking to FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddick. This is FSN Reports. The Obama administration is having to defend its decision to free five Taliban commanders who were being held at Guantanamo Bay in exchange for one captured American soldier.
This was the right thing to do because we in the United States do not leave our men and women in uniform behind during an armed conflict. Prisoner exchanges in armed conflicts are hardly a new development, including in our history in the United States.
White House spokesman Jay Carney earlier. Sergeant Bo Bergdahl was handed over to U.S. Special Forces on Saturday after spending 5 years in captivity. As Republicans slated the deal as a threat to national security, some in the U.S. military ranks have labelled Bergdahl a deserter. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
It was a remarkable image, the President of the United States flanked by the parents of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, the only U.S. prisoner of war in Afghanistan, announcing in the spring sunshine that America had secured his return after 5 years in the hands of the Taliban.
Sergeant Bergdahl has missed birthdays and holidays and the simple moments with family and friends, which all of us take for granted. But while Bo was gone, he was never forgotten. His parents thought about him and prayed for him every single day, as did his sister Skye.
But President Obama paid a price for Sergeant Bergdahl's return. Five senior Taliban figures held since the very first day at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, men previously deemed too risky ever to release, were put on a plane and flown to Qatar. All part of a deal brokered by the Emirates Emir that U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel defended in an appearance on NBC News.
We had information that his health could be deteriorating rapidly. There was a question about his safety. We found an opportunity. We took that opportunity. I'll stand by that decision. I signed off on the decision.
The five Taliban commanders are now subject to a travel ban in Qatar for the next year, but they have been reunited with family members, and the Taliban used social media on Sunday to publish photographs of the men's return. In Washington, the Obama administration found itself on the receiving end of fury from Congress. Republicans say it should have been given 30 days' notice of the intention to free the Gitmo 5, and conservative hawks like Senator Ted Cruz of Texas say the White House has put U.S. national security at risk. He spoke to ABC News.
U.S. policy has changed. Now we make deals with terrorists. And the question going forward is have we just put a price on other U.S. soldiers? What does this tell terrorists?
The White House denies that, but the row will rumble on. Meanwhile, in Sergeant Bergdahl's hometown in Idaho, they're preparing a party to celebrate his return. First, though, further medical care lies ahead in Germany, then at an army hospital in Texas, as the former POW tries to get over his ordeal. Simon Marks, Washington.
This is FSN Reports.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
FIFA President Sepp Blatter announcing Qatar's successful bid to host the 2022 Soccer World Cup, an honour that many officials and fans alike are now calling to be stripped from the country. The furore follows allegations from a British newspaper that Qatar's winning bid was rife with corruption. American lawyer Michael Garcia has been appointed by the international governing body of soccer to investigate the bidding process, which saw the US lose out to Qatar in the final vote. Lisa Aziz on Britain's LBC Radio tackled the controversy with World Cup expert Keir Radnage.
Well, my understanding is that he already had an appointment to meet members of the Qatar bidding team and organising team in Oman this week. He's already interviewed those members of the FIFA Executive Committee who were involved in the vote in December 2010. So this is this week is just the next stage of his inquiries, which have been running now for 2 years, and they're going to run for quite a long time further.
Greg Dyke in particular has been particularly vociferous over the weekend. I mean, any rerun vote sounds like it would be hugely complex. It would be costly. What are the prospects of it actually happening?
I think the prospects are minimal, frankly. The bidding process in the first place was deeply flawed because FIFA had decided to run the 2018 and 2022 bidding at the same time. That opened the way for political machinations in all directions. So basically, if you rerun 2022, you have to rerun the vote for 2018. And with the 2018 World Cup 4 years away, I don't think the Russians and particularly Vladimir Putin would be very pleased with that.
And what about England in the midst of all of that, particularly when it came to 2018? What are the implications there?
I don't think there are any implications at all. England campaigned for 2018. They lost to Russia, who worked extremely hard in just about every direction imaginable to try to win the vote for themselves and were successful. So on that basis, I don't think England some suggestions England will get 2018. No, forget it. That's not going to happen.
Any sympathy at all for the Qatar committee? I mean, they're fully denying any wrongdoing. They say they're cooperating fully with the Michael Garcia investigation.
I think the complication over this, the latest revelations is that as Qatar was bidding for the World Cup, so Bin Hammam himself was winding up a campaign to try to oust Sepp Blatter as president of FIFA. And it's not clear from what the Sunday Times have presented, which is remarkable, I have to say, whether his behind-the-scenes dealings were in essence really about the Qatar World Cup or really about his own personal ambitions.
Keir Radnage talking to LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz. And finally, FSN Spotlight, the part of the show that tries to bring you a story you might have missed. With today's edition, here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the growing relationship between Russia and China. For months now, the Obama administration has been hamstrung at the United Nations because Moscow and Beijing have come together to thwart Washington's efforts to crack down on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. 10 days ago, the two countries signed a landmark deal on gas supplies. They've also struck new agreements on trade and arms sales. So is a new axis emerging on the world stage between Russia and China? And what are the implications for the United States? James Blitz, former Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times, and James King, formerly based in Beijing for the newspaper, spoke to the FT's Gideon Ruckman. James Blitz begins.
I think if you look back over many decades, there's always been a strategic triangle in international relations between the US, China and Russia. And the basis of that triangle is that if two of those three can gang up, then the third often feels under pressure. And of course, what you saw in the 1970s with Nixon's opening to China was that the US and China came together, and that outmaneuvered and to some degree destabilized the situation with the then Soviet Union and left them to some degree diplomatically isolated. What you're seeing now is the US being very much the one who is being excluded within the triangle. In other words, the US has got very bad relations now, both with China on the one hand, because of issues like cyber espionage and the Chinese role in the East China Sea, and of course with Russia in particular because of what's happened in Ukraine. And as a result, with the US excluded, you're seeing China and Russia coming together to a degree that you've not seen in the past. And this deal on gas supplies in many ways crystallizes that and symbolizes that. Now, the question I think we'd want to discuss is how deep that really is, whether this does signify a grand new opening or whether it's something rather more symbolic than real.
So, James King, then, I mean, I can see what's in it for Russia, particularly at this moment. It really helps to play the China card with America. But what's in it for China?
Well, just to consider the deal for a minute, there is a lot in this for China. It's really a bit of a coup if it goes ahead. And I think we need to stress that. I mean, I was reporting on this very deal 10 years ago in China. It's been around for a long time and it's always fallen through. So we need that caveat. But if it goes ahead and Russia does start to export 38 billion cubic meters of gas every year to China, this will be a big thing for China. First of all, it will mean that China gets about just around 10% of its gas needs from Russia every year by the year 2020. It'll also mean that China has a cheaper source of gas because at the moment it's importing LNG. This gas from Russia will cost about 60% of the price of the LNG. This is very important in China because of the domestic imperative to reduce pollution. As we all know, gas is a key element of this. China wants to have its cars, trains, and several other power sources powered by gas in the future, much cleaner than the coal it currently relies on. So as a deal, it's very important. And geostrategically, as James was just saying, it's also really one in the eye for Washington.
So, James, from the Russian longer-term perspective, if one looks beyond the need to play the China card now, does this mean, because as you suggested, the Russian-Chinese relationship's always sort of gone in waves?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that this does matter for Putin at this particular moment, just looking at it from the Russian perspective. Putin has come to this agreement as somebody who clearly has turned his back on the West and who has got a very difficult situation with the West, in as much as Russia and Gazprom, the state-owned energy company, are still selling enormous quantities of gas to Europe. And the risk for the Russians is that the Europeans will turn around and are beginning to turn around and are saying, well, look, if Putin's going to behave like this in this revanchist manner in his own neighbourhood, then we are going to have to make ourselves less strategically reliant on Russian oil and gas than we have been in the past. Now, what Putin is able to say is, aha, you may want to go down that road, but don't think that by going down that road, you are going to be able to influence or contain my foreign policy, because I now have this other card that I am able to play, which is gas sales to China. And in that sense, it is important for Putin at this particular moment to be able to show that. That said, I don't know to what extent this really is a long-term strategic achievement by the Russians. At the end of the day, number one, James has talked about them selling 38 billion cubic feet of gas to the Chinese per year. When this deal, if this deal is finally gets into operation at the end of this decade, that is still less than one quarter of what the Russians are selling to Europe. So it is not going to make up much of the gap if the Europeans strategically move away. And at the same time, Russia and China really cannot in any way be presented in the way the Russians perhaps would like as equal strategic partners on the global stage. At the end of the day, they're poles apart in terms of their stages of economic progress. The Chinese have 7% GDP growth per year. Russia is pretty much stagnant. If you look at the quality of Russian exports to the Chinese, 10 years ago, Russian exports to China comprised only about 10% of those exports were made up of oil and oil-related products. Today, it's something like 70%. In other words, the Russians are not anymore selling the Chinese manufactured goods, weapons, high-tech equipment in the way they used to. In other words, net-net, this is an important symbolic achievement for Putin at this particular moment. But I'd be surprised, James, if the Chinese were coming out of this looking at the Russians in any way as a kind of equal strategic partner. I think to some degree behind the scenes, they're still quite dismissive of the Russians.
Always in Beijing, if you're talking privately with Chinese officials, there is a certain amount of suspicion of Russia. I mean, of course, they fought a war in the 1960s. And there's huge cultural differences. Chinese and Russians don't really see eye to eye as people. It's not really a kind of friendship made in heaven. But I do think that a few big things have changed over the last few years. The first is that China increasingly sees Central Asia and what it calls its near abroad, you know, its northern border, historically terribly important for China, always the place where China suffered from invasions. That's why, of course, they built the Great Wall. But they see this area now as very important strategically. It's by no means a coincidence that when Xi Jinping took a delegation to Central Asia last year, he signed $50 billion worth of investment deals from China to that region, to the Central Asian region. And China also sees its rail links across Central Asia and Russia to Europe as a very important alternative way of getting its products out. It takes about 18 days to go by train from China now to Duisburg in Germany. This is a very important strategic route. Chinese call it the Iron Silk Road. So there has been a big shift in the way that China views its northern border and the territories beyond it. And I think that probably more than compensates for the kind of atavistic suspicion that Chinese have traditionally held Russians in. The other thing to be said to your question about Ukraine is that this appears to me at least to be all part of the same piece. The lesson that China appears to have learned from Ukraine is that the US might be a paper tiger. And it's probably, to me, very revealing that only 4 days after Obama left his four-country trip of Asia, where he went to Japan and other allies in the region, claiming that the U.S. would do everything possible to protect its allies in the region, and even saying that the U.S. would defend Japan against territorial incursions in its outlying islands, obviously intended to be a message to China. Only 4 days after that trip took place, the Chinese were putting up a drilling rig 150 miles off the coast of Vietnam, which has then sparked this very, very tense altercation between China and Vietnam. And what has the US done? Pretty much nothing. Has it said anything strong to China about Vietnam? Not really. Will there be more of a US troop deployment to the region? Maybe there will, but it hasn't happened yet. So my sense is that at the moment, the Chinese may be thinking, the US is a bit of a paper tiger, and the pivot to Asia is a lot more talk than substance.
James King and James Blitz, both of the Financial Times, talking to the newspaper's Gideon Ruckman. There's more coverage from them in the paper and multimedia content on its website, ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Tuesday, as the nation mourns the loss of Maya Angelou, we look at why British schools are abandoning great American literature. That's Tuesday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.